heard from the president lately, you know, that where the president, I think, has sounded somewhat divisive and frankly kind of petty at times, Biden is trying to sound presidential, delivering this message of reconciliation, unity, and resolve in the face of a pandemic with record numbers of cases and increasing numbers of deaths.
260,000 Americans and counting. It's divided us, angered us, set us against one another. I know the country has grown weary of the fight. We need to remember we're at war with a virus, not with one another, not with each other.
You know, David, he talks about how hard it is for families to forego traditional Thanksgiving celebrations, but that it's what's needed in this moment.
Well, then we also did hear from President Trump. I mean, talking to reporters for the first time since the election sounds like what? Not a concession, but maybe getting closer to accepting reality?
That's right. You know, for the first time, President Trump explicitly did say that he will leave the White House if the Electoral College votes for Joe Biden.
Certainly I will. Certainly I will. And you know that. But I think that there will be a lot of things happening between now and the 20th of January. A lot of things.
And, you know, he didn't say what those lot of things were, but I will say that he continues to push these baseless allegations of voter fraud. There really is no route for him to overturn the election results. So at this point, you know, it feels largely like rhetoric, nothing that's going to actually be able to change the outcome.
All right. NPR's Asma Khalid. Asma, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
70 years ago today came the start of a major battle in the Korean War. It was the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir. It was a turning point for the war in that Americans were turned back. But despite the defeat, it remains part of U.S. military lore because American troops survived at all. What did that battle mean, though, for Koreans? NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports.
Korean War veterans and politicians gathered in Seoul in advance of the anniversary. U.S. Ambassador to South Korea Harry Harris saluted U.S. veterans who fought in the conflict.
They answered a call to defend a country they did not know and a people they had never met.
Harris's remarks were a reminder that the U.S. and China are once again jousting for advantage and influence in Asia, and that U.S. alliances are under pressure from within and without. Korea reminds us, Harris said,
that alliances matter.
Communist-led North Korea invaded the South in June 1950 and occupied most of the country. General Douglas MacArthur led a surprise American landing at Incheon and broke the North's offensive. Allied troops pushed into North Korea, heading for the Yalu River on the border with China. Then China joined the conflict on the North side. In a message taped for the commemoration, Lieutenant General Stephen Rudder, commander of U.S. Marine Corps Forces Pacific, described the fighting.
Surrounded and beset by some 120,000 Chinese troops, the battle was fought over some of the roughest terrain during some of the harshest winter weather conditions of the Korean War. The battle for and the breakout from Changjin has become Marine Corps legend.
Changjin is what the reservoir is called in Korean. Some 30,000 U.S., South Korean, and other troops under U.N. command faced the Chinese. Among them was John Lee, a Korea University sophomore when the war broke out. He worked as an interpreter at U.S. 1st Marine Division headquarters at Hagaru-ri on the southern end of the Chosin Reservoir. His mission? Gather intelligence on Chinese troops from North Korean locals.
Because the Korean civilians who were chased out of their house by Chinese, they know when Chinese are going to attack, where they're going to attack, and they told all this intelligence to us.
After fending off 3 days and nights of Chinese human wave attacks, U.S. troops fought their way out of the mountains and retreated to the port of Hongnam. Lee was not trained for combat, but he picked up a rifle and fired at the attacking Chinese troops. He remembers hundreds of fleeing civilians trapped in the north when the Marines blew up a bridge to stop Chinese troops.
There's no other way but to dynamite the bridge. But at the same time, it's kind of a tragedy in my view, really. I really think of it even now. This is a really sad story.
But around 100,000 other refugees did make it out with UN troops as they left the port of Hongnam. Among them were several congregations of North Korean Presbyterians, including Om Dae-song, who was then 19 years old. Now 89, he fights back tears as he remembers how his pastor held a service right on the beach of the harbor.
He wailed and begged God to let us survive. vowing that we'd be even more faithful believers if we make it out alive.
The Christians were among nearly 100,000 North Koreans who made it out, crammed aboard U.S. transport ships. The congregation settled in Seoul, and their church still thrives here. The descendants of the 100,000 Hongnam evacuees now number around 1 million and count among them Moon Jae-in, South Korea's current president. But the original evacuees remain separated from their families. Church member Yang Sung Kwan, 81, still wishes for the chance to visit his former home in the north.
I still get tears in my eyes when I think about my hometown. I can still imagine every alleyway and feel like I can still find my way back to my old home.
After the Chosin Reservoir battle, U.S. and U.N. forces were unable to retake North Korea, and the evacuees were never able to return home. Ned Forney is a Seoul-based amateur historian and grandson of Edward Forney, the Marine colonel who organized the evacuation. He says during the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir, no one was thinking far into the future.
Whether you're talking about the Marines, you're talking about the refugees, there was one thing on their mind, and that was survival.
U.S. forces lost over 1,000 killed in action and another 7,000 mostly due to cold. But even as they retreated, they inflicted far greater losses on the communists. Both sides claimed victory. But this is beyond dispute. The Battle of the Chosin Reservoir ended any hopes of uniting the Korean Peninsula under the South's rule. And to this day, the Korean War has not officially ended. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Doctors and nurses, overwhelmed and exhausted, are trying to come to terms with the loss of life in this pandemic. In Minnesota, one registered nurse has turned to poetry.
Gown, mask, goggles, gloves. I enter your mother's room. The room where she will take her last breath.
Erin Pomerantz authored this piece called COVID-19. She works for Allina Health in Eden Prairie, which is just outside of Minneapolis. And people in her workplace decided to turn the poem into a video.
This poem was based on my first COVID patient, and saying goodbye to the family over the phone was really impactful for me. So I just needed a way to get it out.
It's not fair, you say through tears. I agree, my tears and breath clouding the goggles. A stranger with purple gloves on holds your mother's hands in her final moments, not her son of 63 years.
Erin is a hospice nurse, and so helping others with end of life is what she does. But she says the pandemic has changed even that.
The most sacred part of my job is to be at the bedside of an actively dying person and to be surrounded by family. And that is a great part of that grief process. And it's a type of therapy that is no longer happening.
She hopes her words about this bleak moment reveal resilience and strength.
I have two little boys, and I hope they can look back, or, you know, my grandchildren look back and say, my mom or my grandma was working during this pandemic and she did a great job. And the healthcare workers did a great job.
Deep breath. I push the small red circle and we disconnect. Remove gloves, goggles, mask, gown.
The poem COVID-19 by registered nurse Erin Pomerantz. This is NPR News.
Good morning. You're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:19 right now. Later this hour, the latest from Wisconsin. Today, we look at a question from a listener about the history of the Badgers' Camp Randall Stadium. Stay tuned for that story in 25 minutes. And if you have a question about Wisconsin, you can submit it, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life. Just visit WPR.org/Wisconsin.
I'm Paul Ganchard from Madison, and my company is Ganchard Nursery Landscapes, and we donated a 99 Dodge four-wheel drive pickup that went so well, we donated two larger dump trucks to Wisconsin Public Radio. Some days the speedometer worked, some days it didn't. Unsafe would be a nice word. Had a definite wiggle in the front end as you would drive it down the road. Had the radio gone, that would have been a done deal. It would have been gone, because that truck without public radio wouldn't be worth anything.
Find out how you can donate your old vehicle. Go to WPR.org/support and thank you.
Support for WPR comes from Roth Cheese, maker of specialty cheeses for holiday celebrations. Handcrafted in Wisconsin and available at grocers throughout the state. Holiday entertaining tips and more are at rothcheese.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Red Cross blood donors have a new opportunity to help coronavirus patients. Donors are encouraged to give blood now to help coronavirus patients and others who depend on transfusions have the needed blood products this fall. Visit redcross.org.
Taking a look at the weather forecast today, partly cloudy, light winds throughout Wisconsin, highs in the mid-30s to low 40s, and then clear skies this evening with highs in the 20s. Tomorrow, warming up a bit with a chance for temperatures to reach 50 in southern Wisconsin. It'll get a bit colder as you move up north, but still above average temperatures with highs in the mid-40s for the day. It'll be sunny throughout the state. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, offering a tire decision guide and user reviews to help people find tires that fit their needs and driving conditions. Learn more at TireRack.com. From Merrill, Merrill Guided Investing helps manage a client's portfolio. MerrillEdge.com/investing goals. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, both a registered broker-dealer and investment advisor. From Amazon Studios with the new film Sound of Metal, Riz Ahmed plays a drummer confronting his new world of silence after he abruptly loses his hearing. Also starring Olivia Cooke, starts December 4th on Prime Video. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Nicaragua faces a natural disaster amid a democratic disaster. Daniel Ortega is president of Nicaragua. He came to power in a 1979 revolution and was later voted out. Later still, after the country established more democratic government, he won election as president in 2007. Since then, his government has become increasingly authoritarian. It has cracked down on independent media outlets like Confidencial, whose leader is Carlos Fernando Chamorro. The repression made it difficult to respond to two massive hurricanes that struck Nicaragua and also made it harder for Chamorro's teams to cover it.
I sent reporters to the coast town of Jalover, that has been completely destroyed. Jalover was the place where the hurricane Iota impact with winds of 250 kilometers per hour. Hmm. We also sent another team to the area of Matagalpa, where a mudslide killed 11 people in a community. So you have different impacts in different places. When we were reporting, we had to face the repression by the police. The government have maintained the censorship to the press. They don't want the press to go to the places and talk to the victims because they just want to have control of the information and give us their own version of the truth.
What is it that police of the government of Daniel Ortega are doing to your reporters? Just turning them back when they go along the roads to different places?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. They simply said, you cannot go in. And they also expelled our reporters in a place where the victims have gathered together and they were mourning their death. They said, you cannot talk to them. Just get out of here.
To the extent that you've been able to determine it, given that kind of blockage, how well has the government been able to respond to the needs of people?
The Nicaraguan government, it's not a democratic government. It's a very obscure regime. The Nicaraguan president, Daniel Ortega, have never addressed the nation during these 3 weeks of emergency. There's this confusion between the state duties and the political party and the caudillo leaders of the country. And people are saying that they're discriminating others because of their political beliefs.
Are people being denied aid if they don't have the correct political views?
There are several municipalities that are not controlled by the government. They are controlled by elected officials from opposition parties. Well, those municipalities do not get any support from the central government, and they're basically abandoned.
How, and I realize this is a simple question, perhaps with a complicated answer, how is it that President Daniel Ortega maintains power despite years of protests after more than a decade in office?
Ortega had, until some point, popular support. He lost popular support after April 2018, when we had massive protests against the government. People protested originally for a reform to the health system, but then it became a political protest, and people ended up demanding the president's resignation. The response by the government was violent repression. There are about 320 people assassinated between April 2018 until September that year, more than 700 political prisoners, 100,000 exiles. So how Ortega maintains in power? Well, everything is controlled by a mixture of the police and the paramilitaries. He controls the government. He controls the public employees. And there is a repressive machinery that simply allows him to stay in power.
Do you manage, despite all the restrictions, to get any sense of people's resilience, how they're working their own way through this crisis if they can't rely on the government to help them very much?
There has been a lot of what we call in Nicaragua the spirit of solidarity networks or self-support communities for COVID, for emergencies, and also for political resistance. I mean, we are just waiting for the opportunity to have free elections, and that could change Nicaragua completely.
Carlos Chamorro of Confidencial in Nicaragua. Thanks very much for the report.
Thanks to you.
All right, as many of you probably know already, Sony and Microsoft this month released their new consoles, the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X. If you are a gamer and you've been trying to get your hands on one of these, you've probably been having some trouble.
Because demand is through the roof. And on top of that, the pandemic is affecting typical purchasing habits.
It really has changed the way people are buying the consoles, since you can't go stand in a line and wait and just kind of hang out to get a console. You have to do it online.
Nicole Carpenter is a senior reporter for Polygon, a gaming news publication.
That excess number of people shopping online is just making it a true nightmare.
A true nightmare, because the websites of some of the big retailers like Walmart are crashing. And it's not just because of individual consumers.
You don't know if you're shopping against actual customers or bots.
Bots are programs written to search the web and immediately purchase a console from a reputable retailer. They're depleting online stock in minutes or even seconds. And resellers are using bots to gather up their own stock, which they can then sell again at a huge markup.
But if you are still hoping to buy one of these yourself at market price, there's actually a bot for that, too.
There is a Twitch stream that is running a bot that's checking stock at retailers. Right now, it's just a whole big wall of out of stock, but it plays a sound, so you can just keep running in the background.
Now, the downside of this, those kinds of bots can themselves crash retailer websites, making it impossible for you to buy the PS5 you have finally found.
And there's also the issue of producing enough for demand. The console makers are running short.
Sony has said that it will have more stock before the end of the year. Microsoft is making more as well, but they're just not here yet.
According to Microsoft, there might not be more Xboxes until April. So what is everyone going to do? Well, I mean, there's always Monopoly, or maybe that landscape puzzle that's still missing a few pieces, right? This is NPR News.
So far, the COVID vaccine trials have gone well, but the focus has all been on adults. It's yet to be seen how well the vaccines work in children.
Children are not just small adults, so they do have to be specifically studied in the pediatric population.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How long before we have a safe and effective COVID vaccine for kids? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and the latest news is just ahead. The pandemic has meant less people on the roads this year, but road deaths are actually up in the state. We'll hear more after news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Across the U.S., retailers say they're expecting a lot more online shoppers on this Black Friday because of the coronavirus pandemic. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says it considers shopping in crowded stores and malls to be a higher risk activity. The IRS is accepting responsibility for stimulus checks having been sent to citizens of other countries. As NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer reports, officials previously cited mistakes made by those who received the payments.
The IRS now says it mistakenly sent stimulus checks to some non-Americans who legally receive federal benefits like Social Security. That includes Suzanne Wigforce, a Swedish citizen who mistakenly got a check at her house in Stockholm.
There's no way I'm going to cash this money. It doesn't belong to me. But how much money is bleeding out from the Treasury Department because of these stimulus checks?
The IRS cannot answer that question. And the U.S. government has put no mechanisms in place to prevent these mistakes from happening again if more stimulus money goes out. Instead, the IRS says it is, quote, relying on individuals to voluntarily return these payments. Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
Congress remains at odds over passage of another coronavirus relief bill. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. It's 8:31. I'm Hannah Haynes. While road traffic has fallen in 2020, the number of deaths on Wisconsin roads is on the rise. Figures compiled by the State Department of Transportation show that as of Sunday, 534 people have been killed on roads and highways. That surpasses the 502 deaths at the same point in 2019. Transportation Secretary Craig Thompson says there's evidence that the state is seeing more instances of drivers engaged in risky behavior.
Our Division of State Patrol handled traffic violations where we gave out tickets for people going 100 miles per hour or higher, 500 of those last year. So far this year, and we're not done yet, we're in November, they've issued 1,137 for people driving over 100 miles per hour.
The state has also seen a decline in seatbelt use and concerning levels of impaired and distracted driving. The state has awarded millions of dollars in grants to cultural organizations across Wisconsin to help make up for losses due to the coronavirus. Katie Hopkins found her instrument repair business in Stoughton slowed when the pandemic arrived in Wisconsin back in March. She shifted over to making masks, even developing specialized face coverings for brass, woodwind, and flute players. She's already made hundreds of university music departments. She's already made hundreds for university music departments. Hopkins taught students at Lawrence University in Appleton how to sew the masks. Brian Pirtle is dean of the school's conservatory. He says the masks have been a game changer.
The experiences that make this whole endeavor of music making worthwhile are playing with your colleagues, with your other musicians.
The conservatory has also reduced the size of its ensembles and spaced out rehearsal times amid the pandemic. The number of new COVID-19 infections in Wisconsin continues to tick downward, but health officials are concerned in-person gatherings for Thanksgiving yesterday could lead to a new spike in cases. The state DHS confirmed 5,095 more cases yesterday. The seven-day average for new cases now declined every day since Saturday, but the health department also reported the disease was a factor in 62 more deaths yesterday. You're listening to news from WPR. More online at WPR.org.
WPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from TIAA, who believes their clients' passion will never run out, nor will TIAA's commitment to not only get clients to retirement, but through it. TIAA.org/neverrunout.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Many businesses did not make it to this Black Friday. Maybe you've seen them shuttered in your neighborhood. But those that have endured until now may be in position for a big holiday shopping season. Though it is definitely not safe to push your way into a crowded store, just about anything can be delivered to your door. If it's a gift, hopefully that is done discreetly. NPR retail correspondent Alina Selyuk is covering the story for us. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do retailers expect?
So big picture across the board, all surveys are suggesting the majority of Americans plan to shop in-store or online this week or next. And forecasts suggest we're actually in for a record-setting holiday shopping season. Just to address, I always get this question about Black Friday. Is it dead? And every year I come here and I feel like I declare it dead and then get a bunch of annoyed messages from people who love it.
Not dead.
And I just want to say it's just no longer that obsession with this one single day of the year. You may have heard these ads weeks ago.
This year, Walmart turned Black Friday into Deals for Days, starting Saturday, November 7th. This year, Target has Black Friday deals all November.
Actually, sales began as far back as October in some cases, so a lot of people have already started their holiday shopping and don't intend to stop.
Okay, so we should really think of it as Black Fridays or Black Sunday,
Many
Monday,
days.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or
sales,
something like that.
Sales holiday.
Okay, this is mainly happening online for safety reasons, I assume.
By far, the vast majority do say they plan to shop online on their phone screens because a big thing that happened this year, we got a lot of people becoming online converts for the first time, especially thinking things like grocery, health and beauty products, stuff that we used to have to see first. Well, here's Vivek Bandia, who tracks online shopping at Adobe Digital Insights.
About 31% of consumers reporting that they rarely shopped online or had never shopped online before. And the COVID pandemic was essentially a forcing function.
And when you think about physical stores, every year the International Council of Shopping Centers does a shopper survey. And this year, even this group is reporting a big drop in the number of people who say they plan to physically go shopping. But in that survey, almost two-thirds of respondents said they did plan to go shop at a physical store. It's a lot of people. And so stores are adjusting. You know, they're requiring masks. They're counting customers again to limit crowds. And they're drawing attention to the cleaning measures, which is this like unglamorous thing that stores usually like to distract from. Well, now you've got, you know, sanitizers front and center.
However people shop, what are they shopping for?
Classic stuff. Clothes, gift cards, toys, electronics, smart TVs, home speakers, that sort of thing. For years, we watched this shift toward experiences rather than things. Well, this year we're back to things, you know, until we can start jumping back into massages or classes or whatnot. And especially I'm talking things for the home where we're spending all this time now. More holiday decorations to deck out the houses, books and crafts to occupy time. My favorite hot seller for the COVID time is apparently air fryers are big for, you know, all that comfort food. So many families are still struggling financially. We hear about that every day. They still seem to say they want to feel special, they want to celebrate. The National Retail Federation predicts on average shoppers are going to spend almost $1,000 on gifts, food, decorations, and other holiday things, which is only a little bit less than last year when the economy looked extremely different.
Alina, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
NPR's Alina Selyuk.
All right, President-elect Joe Biden wants to make civil rights a top priority in his administration. Advocates who follow the Justice Department say there is a lot of repair work to be done. Here's NPR's Kerry Johnson.
A few months after Donald Trump became president, he delivered remarks about law enforcement that set the tone for civil rights. Former Justice Department prosecutor Christy Parker remembers.
I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody. Don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
He essentially told them, go ahead and use excessive force. Don't be too nice to the people you arrest.
Parker says that speech marked a major turnaround.
Where I think we see a real fall down by this administration and a purposeful one is in prosecutions of police officers who do their work, you know, out on the streets.
It's not just cases against individual cops who break the law. Veterans of the Justice Department say there's been a retreat on another front, investigating entire police departments for patterns or practices of discrimination. Jonathan Smith used to run that unit at the DOJ.
There's been 70 investigations that were brought, and 25 of those were brought during the Obama administration, and one was brought during the Trump administration.
That's 25 in the Obama years, one under Trump. Smith says states like Illinois, Colorado, and Minnesota have tried to step in to police the police.
But it's very different than the kind of resources and authority that comes from the United States Department of Justice. And I don't think it's a substitute.
Trump's first attorney general, Jeff Sessions, viewed state and local law enforcement as partners. He said federal investigations would demoralize police. In one of his last acts in office, Sessions issued a memo removing a key tool from civil rights enforcers. His memo made it nearly impossible to use court-enforced consent decrees to help oversee police forces. Vanita Gupta ran the Civil Rights Division in the Obama years.
That memo should be withdrawn day one of this new administration.
Gupta says the country is in a different place now when it comes to police oversight.
I think there is no question that George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis this summer really forced a crucial reckoning around race and public safety.
Biden says there has to be accountability, and he wants to bring police and civil rights groups into the White House next year to talk about the issues. Civil rights advocates say the election has highlighted another big action item, doing more to protect voters. Lisa Kyler Barrett is director of policy at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She wants to see lawmakers pass a new voting rights law named after the late Congressman John Lewis. But she says the new Justice Department can act even without Congress.
So the Civil Rights Division has previously played a very active role in enforcing voting rights by bringing cases under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
The law allows justice and others to sue states over discriminatory practices. That's a step the Obama DOJ took, only to be reversed under President Trump. Kyler Barrett says expectations for the new team are high.
We are hopeful to have the Civil Rights Division restored to its intended purpose.
After all, she says Congress created the division more than 60 years ago to protect the most vulnerable communities. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
You're tuned to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42 right now. Good morning. Coming up on Morning Edition, 2020 is a great year to stay inside and queue up a holiday special. Ahead, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour has recommendations for you. We'll hear them in just a bit. Stay tuned.
As I went walking the ribbon of highway.
For Simply Folk's annual sing-along show in January, we're having a virtual house band, and you can join in, singing along to favorite songs with folks across Wisconsin and beyond. It's easy, fun, and everyone's welcome. Just send us a recording of you singing along, and you could win a WPR prize pack. The deadline is December 3rd, so go to simplyfolk.org for all the details.
Support for WPR is provided by Wisconsin Watch. From the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, providing daily coronavirus updates and nonpartisan investigative reporting throughout the state at wisconsinwatch.org.
WGTD.org is your portal to public radio, beginning with local news, station information, program schedules, old programs, and videos. WGTD.org includes links to NPR, Wisconsin Public Radio, and WGTD's Facebook page.
There's just a bit more Morning Edition left today before we transition over to Morning Classics, and Wisconsin Life is coming up next. In the weather forecast, partly cloudy today, light winds throughout the state, highs in the mid-30s to low 40s, clear skies in the evening with highs in the 20s. Tomorrow, warming up a bit, it could reach 50 degrees in southern Wisconsin. It gets colder as you move up north, but we're still expecting above average temperatures with highs in the mid-40s for the day, and it'll be sunny.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from WebRoot, offering home antivirus solutions for protecting personal devices against phishing and other cyber attacks while working remotely. Learn more about WebRoot, an open text company, at webroot.com. From Capital One, offering Capital One Shopping, a downloadable browser extension that searches various sites for shoppers. What's in your wallet? More at CapitalOneShopping.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's 8:45 right now, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a famous building. The story comes as the Wisconsin Badgers football team have canceled another game, this time against Minnesota.
We recently received a question from a listener. John Hansen from Madison wrote to us saying, Camp Randall has more than football history. Could Wisconsin research more of the Native American, Civil War, and namesake history of the stadium? Of course we can, John. Tim Peterson from WPR's Central Time went digging for the answers about Camp Randall's history.
Camp Randall's story begins like many cultural landscape stories. The land where it sits in Madison was occupied by indigenous people going back about 12,000 years.
And I just want to acknowledge that when Europeans migrated to this area in the early 1800s, the Ho-Chunk people were well established here.
That's Daniel Einstein, University of Wisconsin-Madison Historic and Cultural Resources Manager. Einstein says there are Native American archaeological sites all around the Four Lakes region, though little is known about any activity on the site of Camp Randall specifically. We do know, he said, a bit more about how that land was used around the time of the Civil War.
Before the war and after the war, there were state fairs, as well as other major public events like the circus. It was in 1861 that the federal government called upon the states to muster soldiers for the Civil War. And at the time, the governor was Alexander Randall. He identified the former State Agriculture Society fairgrounds as a place for a military training camp. So Camp Randall is a military training ground, lasted for 4 years from 1861 to the end of the war in 1865. Over 70,000 Wisconsin troops moved through the camp, sometimes as many as 5,000 people at a time. By the end of the war, there were 40 barracks, a hospital, officer quarters, stables, a commissary. One of the stories that is particularly interesting to Camp Randall is the period in 1862 when 1,200 prisoners of war, Confederate soldiers, were brought to Madison and were housed at Camp Randall. During that period of just over a month, 140 of the soldiers died mostly from disease and wounds prior to their capture, and those soldiers were buried in Forest Hill Cemetery just here on the west side of Madison.
For nearly 30 years after the war ended, the area that had been the military's Camp Randall went back to being used for the state's fairgrounds. Things changed when the state actually purchased the land in 1893.
The property was being considered for residential development, and the veterans approached the state and said that wouldn't be right to convert these hallowed grounds. So they convinced the state to purchase the property, and it was given to the university for their use, for their exclusive use. And in 1895, the first football game was played on the field next to the agricultural fairgrounds grandstands. And that would have been located where Engineering Hall is right now. So the old grandstand had problems. The bleachers collapsed, and in 1917, the money was allocated to create a new stadium, and the first concrete seating structure was built into the side of Breeze Terrace, that slope on the west side of Camp Randall Stadium. And then subsequently, there were many additions made to the stadium, and now, of course, it can accommodate up to 80,000.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story on the history of Camp Randall. And that story idea came to us from an audience question as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your own question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Riverbend Nature Center announces the Andes Chickadee Trail. It's a new interactive trail designed to engage children and folks of all ages in an unstructured exploration of nature. Visit riverbendracine.org.
Make sure that food gets into the hands and homes of Madison's most vulnerable. WPR is proud to support hope and healing in our communities. Learn more at cookitforwardmadison.com.
Highs in the mid-30s to low 40s throughout the state today. Partly cloudy, light winds, and then in the evening, clear skies with highs in the 20s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. I'm just going to be honest here. During even a normal holiday season, I spend a lot of time with my television. There's football, there are movies, Die Hard, Love Actually, Go Ahead, Fight Me, Go Ahead. Also, I love holiday specials. And I feel like this year, with no big parties to go to, we're going to need all the recommendations we can get, right? Because what else do we really have to do? Well, we have NPR critics Linda Holmes and Glenn Weldon, who co-host NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast with us. Hello, Linda. Hello, Glenn. How are you both?
I'm good, David. I'm good. This is my time of year.
Yeah, it's not necessarily mine, but I'm here anyway.
Good. Well, good. Well, let's enjoy this time of year together. I want to focus with you both on holiday specials that we should really have on our list in this strange holiday season. I guess I wonder, like, are there categories we can put these kinds of specials in, or is it just like listing them?
Yeah, I think you can generally sort them into a few categories. You have like the romantic comedy, which is the two people meet in a small town at Christmas, right? They make probably 50 of those as cable movies every year, literally.
Yeah, and we love them all.
You have like the celebrity musical kind of thing, which is, you know, Mariah Carey or whoever comes out and makes a big splashy Christmas thing. You have your pure family warmth. That's your Christmas Carol adaptations. And but every now and then, and I think we're going to bring you a couple of these, every now and then something comes in kind of at an angle.
Right.
And so
cool.
Those are fun, too.
Yeah. Generally speaking, there is always a lesson to be learned. And the lesson is usually that we are focusing on the wrong thing. Capital W, capital T. And Christmas comes along to remind us of what's really important.
What's really important. I love that. Let's talk about what's really important. So give us your picks for holiday specials we should watch.
Okay, so I will offer you first the movie Happiest Season, which is available on Hulu this week. And it stars Kristen Stewart and Mackenzie Davis as a couple who goes home to the Mackenzie Davis character's parents' place for Christmas, but she's not out to them yet. So she brings home Kristen Stewart and says, "This is my roommate." And so there's a certain amount of like wacky misunderstandings, but there's also this very heartfelt story about the character trying to come out to her parents. There's a lot of stuff kind of between the couple about how does the Kristen Stewart character feel about the fact that her girlfriend's not out to her parents. And it's a lot of fun. It's not perfect. I have some nitpicks, don't you always, but it is your basic kind of warm holiday rom-com slash family movie. And I appreciate it very much on that level.
That sounds perfect. Okay, I'll watch that. And then I want to hear about your nitpicks. Glenn?
Yeah, well, my first pick is the Lego Star Wars Holiday Special on Disney Plus.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and what it is, David, it's right there on the label. It is a computer animated Lego version of all the characters from the most recent trilogy in the main Star Wars franchise. So we're talking Rey, Finn, Poe, Rose, BB-8. Rey goes off on a journey through time, which has her meeting a bunch of the main characters from all 9 Star Wars movies and reenacting a lot of the climactic moments from them along the way. Does she learn a lesson about the true meaning of friendship? Yes, she does. If you or your kids are familiar with the Lego video games or the Lego movies, this is gently satirizing the franchise in much the same way. I really dig its version of the Emperor, who is less a creature of ultimate evil and more the worst boss you've ever had.
Okay.
Also, not for nothing, 44 minutes long, in and out, surgical strike.
Perfect. I'm loving this list so far. Well, Linda, you said you were coming into these suggestions with like new angles. Is there ever anything actually fresh and new holiday season? Like, is that important? Is that what we should be looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, traditionally, particularly in the cable realm, these stories have been extremely white. They've been extremely straight. There are some moves toward making some of these casts more diverse, particularly Lifetime as opposed to Hallmark. Lifetime has diversified its casts a little bit more. And there are a couple things to be happy about this year, I think, on that front. You know, Lifetime has a film that's starring as the female lead, a woman named Ally Stroker, who won a Tony for playing Ado Annie in Oklahoma on Broadway. And she uses a wheelchair. And I don't think I've ever seen kind of one of these big movies give that role to someone who uses a wheelchair. I think that's an interesting move. And Hallmark, the Hallmark channel, has a couple of gay couples that they're featuring this year kind of as B-plots, not the main story. And then you also have some that I think are just interesting structurally. There's the Netflix has a series called Dash and Lily, which is a mini series that I liked a lot. It's based on a YA novel. You know, two kids meet through a mysterious book that they write each other notes in. It's very, very sweet. And she has a family that is Chinese American. So I do think there are small steps. They are small, but they are, I think, happening to some degree.
That's some sort of progress.
Little bit.
Glenn, the final word to you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go real traditional, ultra traditional. I'm going from Lego Star Wars Holiday Special to Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square. That's right, David, Star Wars to Dolly, because you know what I got is layers. So this thing's on Netflix. And it's also right there on the level because this thing is really square, unapologetically so. This is an old school musical. I mean, the Dancing Chorus Boys show up 1 minute in. You can check your watch by them. Big, splashy musical numbers of original Dolly Parton songs. It's choreographed by Debbie Allen. You know what you're in for, and you get it. But, I mean, I think reasonable people can agree Dolly Parton is a fundamental force for good in the universe. She's playing an angel here, so right away, redundant. To some of us, Christine Baranski is a pretty solid argument for a just and benevolent God, and particularly when she gets to sing, as she does here, and particularly when she's playing a snobby, rich, imperious businesswoman who is dead inside and who hates Christmas and hates her small town. This thing does suffer from the classic Scrooge Grinch problem, which is that your main character is just a lot more fun to watch while they hate Christmas than when they go all soft and squishy at the end. But
this is such a Glenn Weldon thing.
Such a Glenn Weldon line.
I liked Scrooge better at the beginning.
He had a better worldview. He was just more practical. Now, she does, but you know, the formula, this is the thing, David, that we're talking about here. The formula is unforgiving. She will learn her lesson. She will learn to embrace Christmas and God and Jesus and you know, town square gazebos, because that's it. That's the deal. And nobody can get away from it.
Well, Glenn, Linda, happy watching. Thank you both so much, as always.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, man.
Christmas on the square. Everybody's there.
Linda Holmes, Glenn Weldon, they co-host NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Walking pears, trees aglow and mistletoe. It's Christmas on the square.
I'm Hannah Haynes. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll have news updates from NPR and WPR every hour for you, as well as news on our website at WPR.org. It's a minute before 9 o'clock. The latest news is just ahead.
Support for WPR comes from EdVest, Wisconsin's 529 college savings plan for families with higher education goals. More at edvest.com. TIAA-CREF Tuition Financing, Inc. Plan Manager.
Support comes from Piasecki Funeral Home, thanking everyone for staying safer at home, along with commending our doctors, nurses, EMTs, and other healthcare professionals, as well as the fire department and all law enforcement for their tireless dedication during this time. Piasecki Funeral Home.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.